I'm Alex, if I haven't met you. It's great to be here with you all. We're actually going to go straight into discussion just for 2 quick minutes. You'll see the discussion questions there. So, I mean, I think you've all met one another, but if you haven't, introduce yourselves to one another, and you'll see the discussion question there. I think about 2 minutes. Go for it. Together? Great, we're going to be carrying on with discussion later, so there'll be lots of time to chat about all these things. But you'll see on the handout I put there one of the kind of like fridge magnet verses that Christians have, you know, one of those verses that is a great encouragement, a wonderful verse. Paul says in Romans 8, 28, "And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose." Paul tells us that for those who love God, everything, all things work together for good. It is one of these extraordinary verses, a fridge magnet verse. It's an amazing promise. But I'm sure that as we were discussing in groups there, we know that a promise like that can be hard to believe. You know, we look at the world around us, and we turn on the news, and we hear about great suffering all around the world. You know, we think about wars in Gaza, wars in Ukraine, terrible things happening every day across the world. Terrible things happening because human beings are doing terrible things to other human beings. And I think it doesn't take us just very long to ask, you know, where is God in all of this? Is God really working together all things for good? Is he in control? I want to begin by telling you about an experience I had reffing a football match. I've only ever done it once, and it really was a terrible experience, so I don't think I'm going to do it again. But I got asked to ref this Sunday league match, and it was these two teams that obviously didn't like each other at all. And I thought I would kind of take a kind of loose approach. So I didn't want to be too interventionist. I wanted to kind of let the game run a bit. But quite quickly as the game began, the team started bickering with one another. And then they started having a go at me. And I was just completely intimidated by this whole thing. And I didn't know what to do. And they got more and more aggressive, kind of a fight started breaking out. Eventually, I thought, I've got to kind of reassert my authority, get some control. I gave someone a red card, and then his whole team stormed off. And the game was actually canceled. So there you go. But I think in lots of ways, it can be quite easy to have that view of God, a kind of helpless ref that has just lost control. When we're confronted with so much evil, so much human evil, you know, it can be on that big scale, thinking about wars and terrible things that are happening, but also on a small scale, on a personal level, we ask ourselves, you know, where is God? Is he in control? For many people, looking into the Christian faith, you know, this is actually the crux. You know, that might be you this evening. This is why you can't believe in God, because he isn't doing anything about evil. So why bother with him? And for lots of us, we would call ourselves Christians, and we're trusting in God, but we do look around at the evil around us, and sometimes it makes us wonder, where is God's goodness? What is he doing? Where's his plan? Has he lost control? And I think this is why this story of Joseph from the book of Genesis is just so great for us. Because Genesis, it basically gives the kind of ABCs of God and humanity. It tells us these are the things that we need to know about ourselves, and these are the things that we need to know about our Creator. And what this story of Joseph teaches us is that even in the mess of real evil, God is in control. There's a wonderful verse at the end of the Joseph story. It's probably worth flicking there, actually. It's Genesis 50, verse 20. And Joseph looks back at all of the events of his life, all of the evil that he's been through, all of the evil that he's seen. And he says this. It's Genesis 50, verse 20, page 44 in these Bibles. Joseph says, "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good. You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good." And what we're going to do this evening is we're basically just going to unpack that verse by looking at this first chapter of the Joseph story, chapter 37. We're going to look at great evil, but we'll see that God was in control. So first, and you can follow along on the handout, we're going to look at the terrible evil of humanity. I hope that some of us were a bit familiar with this story. Hopefully some of us have seen the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical. It's an absolute classic. Loved it in my family growing up. And it has lots of great moments. And this chapter, I think, is a kind of singing and dancing kind of bit. I think that it's like there's one more angel in heaven. I think it's that bit. But really, that musical, it gets the whole tone of this chapter wrong. Because what we're looking at here is not a singing and dancing musical. We're actually confronted with the reality of what God's chosen family looks like, and it really isn't pretty. And it starts with the foolish father, Jacob, who basically makes the kind of parenting mistake 101, which is having a favorite son. So just look up the page at verses 3 and 4. Now Israel, so Israel is another word for Jacob. Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his sons because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a robe of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. So there we have these brothers who are jealous of this brother who's their father's favorite. And so when the opportunity presents itself, well, they want revenge, don't they? This hatred there from Jacob's favoritism, it turns to murder. They get one glimpse of that wretched multicolored robe. And then look there in verse 18. They saw him, that's Joseph, from afar, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. It's a terrible picture of a breakdown of a family. But it is more than that. It's bigger than that. What it gives us is it gives us a picture of a world that stands against God, that hates God. Because you see, the thing about the brothers' hatred, it is not just about Joseph. It's bigger than that. What they really hate is they hate Joseph's dreams. And that tells us a lot. So just look at verses 19 to 20. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams." They hate Joseph for his dreams. And that really says a lot about their hatred, because God's purposes had been revealed to Joseph through his dreams. And those dreams had revealed that Joseph was to be God's chosen ruler. He was to rule over his brothers. He was to rule over this people of Israel. And he would be the one that would bring God's promised blessing to the brothers, to his brothers. And his brothers hate that. They hate the idea of Joseph ruling. And they don't want it God's way. They hate God's plan, so they want to get rid of this wretched dreamer. And this is the thing that is at the heart of human evil. This is what Genesis teaches us again and again. At its root is this hatred for God, a hatred for God's ways. It's a strong word, isn't it, hatred? But think of the way we think about the thought of authority. You know, we don't like the thought that God is actually in charge, that God is actually in control. We want to be captains of our own fate. You know, we want to go our own way. But what this shows us is, you know, it's ridiculous to be shaking our fists, to be shaking our fists at the God, the creator, who is above us all. And ultimately, it sends us down a horrible path. And that's what we see here. The further the brothers go on, the more horrible the path gets. So back to the story. Joseph, he's half rescued by his older brother, but still you can see there in verse 24, then they decide to take him and throw him into a pit. The pit was empty, no water in it, and then they sit down to eat. So just picture that, really. I think it's shocking. They've stripped him of his robe. They've chucked him in a pit. They're ignoring his cries for mercy, and then they sit down to start munching on their dinner. Just think, it's their own brother in front of them, and this is what they're doing. And it gets even worse. We meet this guy, Judah, who thinks, well, come on, guys, let's at least make some money out of all of this. So he says in verse 26, what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. And you see the brothers listen to him. And so off Joseph goes, sold into slavery at just 20 shekels of silver. It is a picture of hatred, of jealousy, of greed. It's a brutal story. It's horrific. And the brothers, they then cover up their tracks. And of course, their father, the old man Jacob, well, he's left thinking that this his beloved son, the one he made this multicolored robe, is dead. It's a picture of evil. And I think it's a difficult story, isn't it? It's so far from that singing and dancing musical that we all know. And I think it can feel maybe distant from 21st century London life. And yet I'm not so sure that it actually is. You see, this isn't meant to be a distant story that we hold far apart from us. Remember, these people, this is God's chosen family. I was watching the BBC show Who Do You Think You Are a few years ago. It was a fun evening, and it's the show where they go back and look at a famous person's family history. And in this episode, they were looking at the history of the family of the pundit Alex Scott. And she found out that her great-grandfather had owned 26 slaves. And she was just completely shocked. You know, she couldn't believe that there were those kind of skeletons in her family's closet. And I think that kind of shock or that kind of despair, that's the kind of effect that this story is meant to have. Because here we have the founding fathers of Israel. The guys who first read this book, they would have traced their lineage back from one of these men. And as they look at this story, they'd have been confronted with the reality of real evil in their family. And the heart of that problem, that desire to reject God's rule, to reject God's purposes, they knew that was there in them. And it's there in each one of us. It's kind of a sad truth that if we could actually look back at the family history of each one of us, there would be some wonderful things, I'm sure, but there would also be some horrible things. You know, we would see sibling rivalry, we would see hate, we would see murder, we would see evil. This is the reality of human history. We've set ourselves against God, and it leads to mess. We live in a broken world, broken because of human sin, and we're so often the problem. And so we've got to go back to that question that we were asking at the beginning. Where is God? Has he lost control? Where's his plan? So that takes us to the second point on the handout. God uses evil for his good purposes. The terrible evil of humanity, God uses for his good purposes. I'm sorry to go back to football one more time, but it's obviously been on my mind. But I've been a Liverpool football fan for my whole life. And for years, Liverpool Football Club were plagued with if-only moments. You know, the kind of moment where you just think, if only that hadn't happened. And famously, you may not know about this or remember it or care about it, but the legendary Liverpool captain, Steven Gerrard, had never won the Premier League. And finally, in 2014, Liverpool were top of the league going into the last month. So everyone was getting very excited. Liverpool are going to win. And then very tragically, Steven Gerrard slipped, caused Liverpool to concede a goal, which they then lost the game, which was basically the cause of Liverpool not winning the league that year. It was the definition of an if-only. And this chapter is full of those kind of if-only moments. You know, moments where we think, how did that happen? How did that lead to that? And we can see that at the beginning of our verses. It's easy to miss. Just look back at verses 15 to 17. And a man found him, that's Joseph, wandering in the fields. And the man asked him, "What are you seeking?" "I'm seeking my brothers," he said. "Tell me, please, where they are pasturing the flock." And the man said, "They have gone away, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. It's a really agonizing little moment, this. This kind of random man turns up in this field, and he just happens to be hanging around in the right field. He just happens to ask Joseph what he's doing. He just happens to know where Joseph has gone, where Joseph's brothers have gone. And so it's that which sends Joseph off to his brothers, far away from his father's protection, straight to into their murderous path. And it's not the only moment in the story like that. Can you imagine how much in the years to come Joseph must have replayed these events again and again in his head? Stephen Gerrard says he wakes up every morning and he thinks about that slip. Well, think about what it must have been like for Joseph. There's a moment where he could so easily have been killed. Then he could so easily have been rescued by his brother Reuben. He could so easily have been left to just rot in that pit. And then the slave traders, well, they could have been going to anywhere, but then they just happened to be going to Egypt. At each moment, it could have gone another way, but it didn't. And you see, the author of Genesis is teaching us something really significant here. Something is going on behind all of this. There's an author behind these events. They're not just a series of random coincidences. And we can start to see that at the end of our chapter, just in that last verse. Let me read it again, verse 36. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. This is the kind of ray of light here. Joseph ends our chapter in Egypt, and he ends our chapter just one person away from the most powerful man in the world at that time. He's right next door to Pharaoh. And Joseph will look back at these events from this chapter and say to his brothers, "It's not you who sent me here, but God." These were not just a series of random events. God was in control. He was in control of it all, even the most terrible evil of Joseph's brothers. Joseph had been rejected. He'd been abused. He was as good as dead. And yet this was part of God's plan to take Joseph to the very top of Egypt. This was part of God's plan to save many people. This was part of God's plan to redeem this wicked family. It is a really wonderful story. And if you have any chance over the next week, why not read through the rest of Genesis? It's a wonderful story of God's sustaining grace, his sovereignty, his control, bringing about his good purposes. Remember chapter 50, verse 10, 20. Let me read the whole verse. "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today." And this truth about God's good control, his good purposes being worked out in all things, this is a massive truth. This is something that I think can change really our whole attitude to life, because we can have real confidence in the God of the Bible. You know, I think we rightly despair when we see evil all around us. I think we're dismayed when we see the evil in our own lives. But we can trust that God is in control, that he has good purposes, plans for salvation, plans that we might not see them all now. I'm sure Joseph, when he was rotting in that pit, couldn't see what was happening, but he did eventually. And the Bible promises that we will too one day. And I know that that's a big truth that can bring up some important questions. So I really hope that we have some good chance to chat afterwards and to work those things through. But as we come to a close of this bit, I'm sure many of us will be able to say that this is our testimony, that we've seen God working out his good purposes in our lives. I was speaking to a guy I used to live with a few months back, and he was telling me about some of the things that he's had to endure in his life. He's come from a pretty broken family where his father was an alcoholic, and he faced some really difficult things in his 20s. But it was amazing. He spoke about how it seemed so clearly through those years how God is faithful, how God can even work through the most terrible things to bring about good for those who love him. He'd seen it in his own life on a micro scale. And I'm sure many of us here will be able to say exactly the same. You know, it's true that we often look at our current situation. We look at the world around us, and we aren't able to explain what is it that God is doing. But I think the key in those situations really is then to look at Jesus, because actually the life of Joseph, it is a mini picture of what we see in the life of Jesus. Because Jesus was abandoned by his followers, betrayed for just a few coins of silver, rejected by his own people, strung up on a cross, executed by the Romans. Jesus' death, I think it was the most terrible evil, God's own son murdered on the cross. And yet we see in Jesus' death that was God's plan to save the world. Jesus died so that many would be saved. He died so that people like us, people like Joseph's brothers, could be forgiven, could have a relationship with God. And so when we are confronted with that question of, you know, what is God doing? What are his purposes? I think it's then that we need to look at the cross, because that is the ultimate demonstration of what humanity meant for evil, God meant for good. And it's that which means that we can say with confidence that verse in Romans 8, we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good. I'm going to pray, and then we'll turn to discuss. We know that for those who love God, all things work together for good. Father, we do pray that you would help us each to believe that, to know that. Please help us when we do question that, when we doubt that. Help us to look to Jesus, to look at what he achieved on the cross and what was vindicated in his resurrection. Please give us confidence, and please help us to trust you in all things. Amen.